I'm born on October 16th, 1942. And Holland, where I'm born, is occupied by the Germans. And I have a chapter that deals with only one topic, the first chapter, and that's the knocking on the door when they come to your house. That's the topic of the chapter. And unless you have internalized that knocking, it's a knocking that says that you have no escape, that your life is over. Unless you have internalized that knocking, you don't understand the Holocaust. They knock on your door and they take you away. Thank God nobody in this room has ever had such an experience. No one in this room has had such an experience. But you have to imagine it. They come to your house and they take you away. You leave half a chicken in the refrigerator. You leave your dry goods, your dry cleaning in the store. They take you away. I talk in the book about Holland because that's where I'm from. There were 135,000 Jews in Holland when the war began. After the war, there were 20,000-30,000 Jews left. They went from house to house and collected every Jew, and they brought them family by family, group by group, to a camp in Holland called Westerbork. Westerbork was the weirdest spot on earth. Westerbork was a camp where there was plenty of food. Westerbork was a camp that had a soccer team and a beauty parlor and a store where the illusion was you were being taken care of very nicely. I mean, it was a prison camp. You were not alone. There were actually small barracks that had families, single families. But mostly you were in barracks of 2,000 people, with the women on one side and the men on the other side. And up to 10,000 people at a time were in Westerbork. Westerbork had a hospital with 1,000 beds. And if you were sick, you went to the hospital and you were taken care of, listen to me, in the hospital. You were taken care of, it wasn't phony. There were several operating theaters, there were weekly conferences by the medical staff, which was the best in Holland. The medical staff wrote published papers about your case. This was Westerbork. There was a concentration camp in Holland near Westerbork called Vught, V-U-G-H-T, Vught. Vught was a horror place. Vught was like Auschwitz, except it didn't have a killing center. But just the treatment of the Jews there killed them. It's what a regular Nazi camp. And Fucht every day, Fucht had an appel, that is to say, the people were put into the middle of the camp and counted every day for hours and hours and hours. And there was a woman in that camp who was standing there who was pregnant. And she stood and stood at the appel. Second month, third month, and the baby dropped. Just from standing, gravity took over, and the baby dropped. The people, the administration of Fuch, didn't know what to do with her, and not with the baby. So where did they send her? Tell me. Westerbork. She comes to Westerbork with the baby, and we have a video of a nurse from Westerbork describing this baby. Willy Lindver produced a film called Westerbork, in which he has this nurse, extraordinarily eloquent nurse, talking about this baby. And here's what she says. She says, the baby comes in, immediately they get isolate, or what they have another word for it?
Incubator.
Have an incubator. And they assign a team of doctors to this baby. Team of doctors, and the nurse who took care of that baby, who was specifically assigned to the baby, said everybody was a team to get this baby to survive. She says, you have never seen so much love and so much concern thrown into a baby. She said, and slowly, she said, this is her words, they're unforgettable. The flame of life, she said, started to take. And she said, one of the requirements of the physicians was that every day in a little stopper, they should give the baby a little bit of cognac. And the Nazi commandant of the camp also got into it and brought his own personal bottle of Hennessy cognac to the hospital to get this baby alive. And she said, the fans of life, the flame, started to take. And finally, she says, the baby was strong enough and taken out and given to the mother. And the next day, mother and daughter were sent to Auschwitz. To understand that story, you understand Westerbork. Westerbork was a great place to be, except on Monday night, because on Monday night, they went into each barrack and they read the list of who is going to be on the Tuesday train to the east. Some days to Auschwitz, some days to Sobibor, some days to Theresienstadt, some days to Bergen-Belsen. One train, 11 a.m. Tuesday morning. And so on Monday night, you stayed up, and you listened to see if you would be on the list. And you prayed, and you did what you could. You gave away your jewelry. You slept with anybody that was interested, just so that you would not be on that Monday night. The commandant of Westerbork did not care who was on the train. There was a group of German Jews that organized the names for him, and he was perfectly happy as long as the train was full in the morning. So instead of sending your own children to Auschwitz, you sent your neighbors. No one spoke out. Nor should you, because if it was a question of your children or your neighbor's children, don't be so sure that you'd know what you do. This was 100,000 Jews went to, 108,000 Jews went to their death this way. Quietly, systematically. My family and I got to Westerbork on September the 29th, 1943. We were not there long. On February the 1st, 1944, we departed from Westerbork to Bergen-Belsen. By that time, most of my family, my extended family, was already murdered in mostly Sobibor. If you went to Sobibor, the important thing to understand about Sobibor is you got to Sobibor at 9 o'clock. By 12 o'clock, you were dead. 3 hours was the maximum amount of time. By the time we got to Westerbork, they were no longer sending trains to Sobibor. Sobibor was already over. And so we were again, Shem was looking after us. Very, very lucky. We got to Bergen-Belsen. Now, it takes a certain amount of irony to say that we were lucky when we got to Bergen-Belsen. But the truth was, oh, by the way, we got to Bergen-Belsen on February the 1st, 1944. Guess what day of the week February the 1st was?
Shabbos?
No. When did I say they came and called the names? So what day was February 1st? That's when I got there. The commandant of Westerbork, the guy who provided the cognac, who saw to the extermination, if that's the word, of 108,000 Jews, quietly and organizedly, after the war was caught, he was tried in Holland, and he got 7 years, with 3 years off for good behavior. Or for a time already served, or something like that. He returned to Germany and lived happily ever after. And there are survivors of Westerbork that got telegrams from him on the occasion of their children's wedding, saying "Mazel Tov." So we are in Bergen-Belsen in February 44. February 44, Bergen-Belsen, if you had to be in a camp, Bergen-Belsen was the place to be. Bergen-Belsen was not at that point an extermination camp. Bergen-Belsen at that point was not what they call the Vernichtungslager. They weren't killing people. There was food. There was what to drink. And they baked matzahs at Pesach in Bergen-Belsen. What was Bergen-Belsen? Bergen-Belsen was a place that if you had a good passport or were of interest, right, to the Germans for future prisoner exchange at the end of the war, that was where you were sent. Bergen-Belsen and Theresienstadt. Those two camps. So we were in Bergen-Belsen. My mother, my father, and I. Family unit intact. And everything was, I wouldn't say hunky-dory, we were prisoners and there was no life. But we lived in a section of Bergen-Belsen called the Sternlager, the Star Camp. Why was it called the Star Camp? Because it wasn't set up as a prison camp. You were not wearing prison garb. You wore your own clothes. If you wore your own clothes, what was on your clothes? The stars. That's why it was called the Star Camp. The first week of April, they decided to empty. No, I'm getting ahead of myself. Everything is hunky-dory in Bergen-Belsen until December 1944. Watch the dates carefully. December 1944, Germany is seriously losing the war. You with me? Watch the dates. December 44. When they see that they're losing the war, there's not enough time to hide the evidence. And so instead of slaughtering everybody, there's not enough time to kill all the Jews in the camps. And even if you could kill all the Jews in the camps, most of which you've already done, you don't have where to hide them and to bury them. So what they did is they started what we now call the death marches. And the marching, what time of year is this? Okay, imagine the same temperature as us. The death marches from camps all over Poland, and many, many of them are headed to Bergen-Belsen. So that a camp that was, quote-unquote, adequate for 8,500 people, suddenly, by the end of December 44 and the beginning of January 45, a camp that was adequate for 8,500 people now has 40,000 people in it. And that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is that they have 40,000 people in it with no increase in food, no increase in sanitation, and no increase in drinking water. And all hell breaks loose. Everybody gets dysentery. Everybody gets typhus. I don't like to talk about typhus in a shul. I have to remember where I am. But typhus means that you lose all control of your bowels. And the great literary critic, Terence Dupré, has a chapter in his book called Excremental Assault, in which he describes what was going on with typhus. You cannot and you should not imagine what excremental assault meant. It meant that 30,000 people could not control their bowels. Can you imagine what that means? You are living, we were living, in a bunk, three high, and no one has the strength to get off the bed to go to the bathroom. And when you go to the bathroom, and you, because human dignity is what it is, and you get to the bathroom, there are a dozen seats in a semicircle, and 30 times that number waiting for a seat, and no one in control, and then you start to understand what Bergen-Belsen was. You had no control over your bowels. You had 104, 105 fever. You were completely crazy from what's it called? Delirium. And people died like flies. My mother weighed 50 pounds. Her normal weight was 120. In those months. You lost most of your body weight. And the fact that you were sitting and talking to people and they died. Having a chat with somebody and they died. There was nothing inside them. I don't want to even build your imagination here. Three trains in the beginning of April of 45, three trains leave Bergen-Belsen. They empty the star camp. And they want to send all the inmates of the star camps, of the star camp, they want to send them to Theresienstadt. The first train leaves on one day and is liberated by the Americans near Berlin. Second train, made largely of Hungarians, makes it to Theresienstadt. The third train disappears from the face of the earth. A woman just published a book at Yad Vashem on Bergen-Belsen, and she, the scholar, still doesn't know what happened to the third train. I know what happened to the third train because I was on it. Third train travels for 14 days looking for railway lines, right, to get to Theresienstadt, which is Czechoslovakia, and cutting through Germany and Poland, and it can't find tracks, and it's bombed by American planes because they think that we're German soldiers. The train travels and stops and travels and stops, commandeered by the SS. There was nothing to eat on the train. There was nothing to drink. And the SS let certain groups of people off the train when it stopped to forage and to bring back what they could. And there is a picture, the photograph, I saw it after I published the book, of the train with some people cooking on the side of the train. The train, by the time it was liberated, on the Polish border, in a German town called Troubitz, by the time it was liberated, the train had 1,700 people left from the 2,500. All along the way, they stopped and they buried people along the side of the train. They had a Chevra Kedisha that did as careful a burial as they could. The head of the Chevra Kedisha at the time was a 17-year-old big strapping youth by the name of Shlomo Samson, who was alive and well and living in Kibbutz Shluchot in Israel. I just visited him, gave him a copy of the book. And he does not consider himself a hero, and he did what he needed to do. And my father died in this town, the small town on the lake, a village really of 700 people. And he's buried there in what they call a kever achim, a mass grave. But the town itself opened itself up to the Jews that landed there, did the best they could, and subsequently built a Jewish cemetery for all the typhus victims, the Jewish typhus victims. And the Jewish cemetery there, I go to it every couple of years, to my father's kever, even though he's mixed with Jews and Gentiles. Gentiles in the town got typhus from the Jews. And they take care of that Beis HaChaim like you wouldn't believe. It has a place for Netilas Yadayim right outside the cemetery. It's an unbelievable place. Never had a Jew ever lived in this town of Trobitz. And never did a Jew live there again. But they take care of that cemetery. And so, the part of my story that I want to talk about begins after the war. And Trobitz ends for me with my first secure memory of the Holocaust, by which I mean a memory I'm certain of. It is also my worst memory of those years. Mother, as I have said, given up for dead in Trobitz. Father, already buried in a mass grave there. And I find myself in what I was later to learn was the railroad station in Leipzig, alone, and with a sign on my chest bearing my name and nationality. It was raining and very dark. There was only one thought, not where was my mother, not where was my father, but a terror. Who will take care of me? This terror of the world has never left me. Deep in my bones, I continue to live with what is contrary to what my mind knows to be different, that the single most important lesson of the Holocaust is that our capacity to take care of each other was taken away from us. As often as I have consoled the bereaved and the stricken, as often as I have accomplished this task myself, still do I not believe that the capacity for people to console each other is an inevitable part of the human experience. The Holocaust has fashioned that within me, a myth, a false one to be sure, but one from which I cannot recover, and within me remains a three-year-old trapped in moral lies. A train from Leipzig took me to Holland, and this is where my tale picks up. Spring, 1946. I am riding breathlessly on the back of a scooter, my arms wrapped around the broken-in mail jacket in front of me, my head buried deep into it, one eye only taking in the colors, the sun. He and his wife had adopted me. I remember only his back, no face, no name. Gloriously we putter through Elysian fields of golden hay and summer greenery. Let this ride never end, I ask. It does. And we arrive at the Catholic hospital in Eindhoven. Gingerly he helps me down, fearful of my pallor, my fragility. We are in a room. Everything is white. The ceilings are very high. There is a woman in the white bed with the white bars, surrounded by the whole Catholic Church, nuns, priests. There wasn't a lot of room and it was getting hot. Someone signals me to greet her. Hello, madame, I say. The jacket that brought me there this far says, she is not Madame, she is your mother. After the Holocaust. My mother, my whole being rebels at the word. My body shakes. Somewhere inside me I scream a cry so grief-struck, so thunderous that no one is left in the room save for the woman in the bed. I look at her shattered form, her rheumatic, deformed legs, the Holocaust madness still in her eyes. My mother? Not, I scream silently, not! The jacket has left. His warmth, his reassurance, puttering into a distance not meant for me. Can a child actually want to die after the Holocaust? Joseph, she says, Joseph, yes, I am your mother. He doesn't seem to recognize you, the church says. It is possible that he isn't yours, isn't it? Children get lost, displaced, mix-ups are common. We really cannot let you keep this child unless we are sure he is yours. Whoever he is, you can be sure that the church will take very good care of him. She understands the stakes, she always does. That's how we survived. Joseph, she says, Joseph, come here. There is kindness in the horror of her form. I come. He doesn't recognize me, she says to the church, because the last time he saw me, I weighed 70 pounds less than I do now. Come, sit here, she says to me. We'll play a little. I want no part of her wretched, morbid form. I don't sit. I feel I'll vomit. I don't understand the church. She says to the church, there are too many people in this room. How can I reacquaint myself with my child in the middle of a theater? Can you all please leave? The church leaves, save for one or two, ostensibly the decision makers. She speaks to me with love, gently, gently. Do you remember how we used to read Little Red Riding Hood together? How I would read one line and you would finish the rhyme in the next line? She tries it. I respond haltingly with the rhymes. Soon I cannot control them. They pour out rhyme after rhyme, verse after verse. Thus did I sing that morning the poetry of Bergen-Belsen, of the corpses I played around, of the typhus feces that were my sandbox. Thus did I sing the song of the hunger and of the fever, of the cold that does not let up, of mother washing my body with her coffee rations. Thus did I sing then on the morrow after the Holocaust, of the rhymes of the angel of death. Thus did my song echo the rattle in father's chest as he reached up skyward to call out to his brothers, long gone in Sobibor, that he too was coming. Church leaves. There is a drawer in the white, white table next to the white bed with the white bars. Open it, she says to me. Inside, a small mountain of foil-covered chocolate. Deep in the mountain, I rescue a small pair of tzitzis and a small, exquisite red sitter. What are they? I ask. You are a Jew, she says to me. And Jews need these things. Our first conversation after the Holocaust. I stay with mother in the hospital for I don't know how long, under a year, maybe a lot less.
I just don't know.
And then we move to a home for Holocaust survivors in The Hague, mother and I. We share a bedroom upstairs, very nice home, an elegant home. I recently revisited it and remembered it. And after the Holocaust in 1946, the Jewish Home for Survivors of The Hague sold its leavening to a Gentile before Passover, as Jews had been doing for thousands of years. It sold it as if the Holocaust had never taken place. Not a beat was missed, not a hesitation apparent. I have in my possession the original certificate of sale. The Jews gathered at the table for this, my first Seder, battered, limping, palsied, unreal, snuffling, without joy, barely looking at each other. We sang Dayenu that year. That was the year I learned the melody. They sang Dayenu that year, these Jews who in Westerbork had witnessed the hospital being emptied and its patients put on trains to Auschwitz, thereby putting to bed any illusion that Auschwitz was a labor camp. These self-same Jews who, with the arrival of a new train every Tuesday morning, heard the death knell toll for them, these Jews sang, if you had taken care of us in the wilderness, Almighty God, and not provided us with the manna, Dayenu, that would have been enough. They sang Dayenu that year, these Jews who had their children snatched screaming from their hands in Westerbork and tossed onto the train to Sobibor, these self-same Jews who waved to their children as the train pulled out of the camp, a train no one in heaven nor upon the earth saw fit to stop, these Jews sang, if you had given us the manna, Almighty God, and had not given us the Holy Sabbath, Dayenu, that would have been enough. They sang Dayenu that year, these Jews who had witnessed the departure of the last train to leave Westerbork for the east. The train filled with the unbekannte Kinder, the unknown children, the ones whose parents had preceded them on the train trips to the gases and the shootings and the burnings. The children who had forgotten their names, who were inarticulate, who were pre-articulate, who held each other's hands, their eyes frozen in fear. These self-same Jews who screamed and never again slept through the night for having seen those eyes. These Jews sang, if you had given us the Holy Sabbath, Almighty God, and had not given us the Torah, Dayenu, that would have been enough. They wept through Dayenu that year after Holocaust. I think the last section that I want to do with you two very short pieces and then we'll end. And so it came to pass, at the end of December 48, my mother and I, on a train from the port of New York to Montreal, crossed the Canadian border at Rouse's Point, and made our way to Grandmother's apartment at 4485A Esplanade Avenue. There, my mother's mother stared purposefully at her daughter, took her in, gazed at a young woman whose hands were already gnarled from rheumatic arthritis, whose legs were bent and stiff and distended, who could not stand straight and who walked very poorly. So it came to pass that Grandmother looked over her daughter and perceived in an instant the horrors that had befallen her. So it came to pass that Mother said to daughter in quiet, certain terms, "I do not ever want to hear about what you went through in Europe. You are starting a new life here." The last part of the book argues that the Holocaust never leaves survivors. It goes into hiding a little bit, comes out. And the book ends when I'm 10 years old. Circa 1954, Mother remarried. "For me," she always said, "so I could have a father. Nice guy, too." I wasn't invited to the wedding. I was too sallow, too pale, too volatile, too unpredictable, too Michigan. I reminded whoever saw me of hunger, disease, and death. I didn't have a place at joyous occasions. I saw bride and groom drive off in the blue Plymouth, dressed to kill and happy, with nary a thought of what all this might mean to me. My hostess, Mrs. G, was close to 90, filled with love and very attentive, babysitter, but I stayed at her house. She even provided me with reading materials. I read love comics the whole night. I don't know that I slept at all. Couples falling for each other, endless kissing. I totally didn't get it. Come to think of it, I don't think anybody had kissed me by then, unless Grandmother's occasional slobbering on my cheek counted. After the marriage, there was a new family to meet, his. They had a summer home in a Laurentian village by the name of Prefontaine, and pretended up to a point that I was one of them. Prefontaine was known for its exquisite clean air and tuberculosis sanatorium, which terrified me to the point where I didn't want to breathe outside lest I catch some of the dreaded microbes. Prefontaine had a lovely rolling river where people fished and swam, a shul, a mikveh, and a pool hall where they sold pink ice cream called Tootsie Putsie, and where teenagers gathered for hours to flirt endlessly. I never swam, I never fished, I never flirted, and it would not be much of an exaggeration to say that I never spoke. "You're so quiet, Joseph," I was told repeatedly. I never replied. The year Mother married, an iceman came every few days to the Prefontaine cottages to deliver a new massive block for the icebox. The house also got fitted with a new indoor toilet. Once it was installed, Mother and I were told rather unceremoniously that the new toilet was only for veteran members of the immediate family, but that she and I were welcome to use the old outhouse that was still happily ensconced some 30 yards down the path leading to the railroad tracks. To my horror at this announcement, Mother was immediately transported to the excremental assault that was Berg Belfort. I could feel the feces on the straw mattresses attacking her nostrils again. I could hear her retching just thinking about the communal outhouse toilets where there never were enough seats and where the people with diarrhea, half the camp, couldn't wait. Although she didn't say it, I knew she was thinking that where you poop is important, and even more important, therefore, is who decides where you poop. She would have none of it. My legs, she said, are not flexible enough to travel this path and fight the weeds and the grass. That night, she screamed at her new husband for not speaking up in outrage, and later wept quietly. Having a father, I reflected, might turn out to be costly. I, on the other hand, loved the outhouse and frequented it all the time. There was something familiar, even comforting about it. Perhaps it provided me with a badly needed dose of my past. My grade 7 class was made up of 40% child survivors in Montreal. No one ever spoke about it. About 10 years ago, I gave a Holocaust talk in Toronto, and a guy from one of my high school classes showed up, and I looked at him and he looked at me and came over to me. He says, "You remember me?" I said, "Sure." I said, "Sir Atsky." He says, "Yeah." He says, "Auschwitz." Holocaust does not go away. And because of what I told you this morning, I have made you into witnesses. What you heard is testimony. And when you hear testimony, you too become witnesses. I told you a fraction of what's in the book. The book I deal with God, in the book I deal with Israel, and in the book I try to be positive so that we do not drive our children mad, which we could do. I'm the luckiest guy walking on the planet because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was at my side every step of the way. And just as I can never, ever forget that, so can I also not forget that there were 1.5 million children. 1.5 million children that are standing at the entrance to Gan Eden and saying to God, "What about us?" Okay.
Rabbi Pollack is available for a question now.
Rabbi Pollack, how did your grandmother get to Montreal and she didn't go through any of what you did? Your mother went through?
So, okay. The question was, how did my grandmother get to Montreal? My grandfather and her and the family lived in Holland in the teens and the 20s. He was a big chazan. He was the chief chazan of The Hague. And in 1921, he got a job in New York for the high holidays, for which he got paid $10,000. And he was not going to turn it down. I mean, in those days. And he got fired, I think appropriately. I mean, you know, he had a contract. And so the family moved to Montreal, where he became chazan after chazan. They had great chazanim in the shuls in those days, and he was a star among stars. My mother was his accompanist. His name was, my name, Avraham Yosef Levinsky. My mother was his accompanist. And
Your mother or your family?
My mother. My mother was his accompanist. My mother was a concert pianist. From one. But she was a concert pianist. And she would play for him. And all the great chazanim, Yossel Rosenblatt and all these people would come to our house. And they would jam. And she would play for accompany everybody. And then suddenly, so money was always a big issue because this is the Depression. And he lost his shirt on Wall Street. And eventually he died at the age of 49 in 1935. Just dropped dead of a heart attack. And I think we just lost... Is it on?
Yeah.
My mother had no reason to remain in Montreal. She saw herself as Dutch, and my grandfather was not there anymore. So she moved back to Holland. But the rest of the family... She actually moved with a sister, a woman called Rosie. Rosie, my mother, went back to Holland. Rosie died almost when she got there from some dreadful disease. And my mother, in a year or two, met my father and married him there. And that's how we got to be in Holland before the war.
You were 3 years old on that train to Bergen-Belsen?
No. I was 3 years old in the hospital scene of reconciliation with my mother. I wasn't even.
So how did you survive as an infant with no food for 14 days, no fluids for 14 days?
In Bergen-Belsen, it's in the book, in Bergen-Belsen, there was an SS officer who took an interest in me. And we were close with a woman, who worked in the bakery. The SS officer brought my mother 2 bottles of milk every day. And Mrs. Pfeiffer brought 2 loaves of bread every day from the bakery. We didn't need 2 loaves of bread, and we didn't need 2 bottles of milk. We needed 1 of each. We exchanged basically 1 loaf of bread for a bottle of milk, and that's how we survived in those horrible days in Bergen-Belsen. Because this SS guy, when I asked my mother after the war, what was his name? She didn't say she didn't know, but she didn't say either. When I asked Mrs. Pfeiffer, Raisel was there in Montreal, who was this SS guy? Mrs. Pfeiffer didn't remember. Oh, how old was I when they knocked on the door? I was in utero. I was in utero. She was in her 9th month. I have a whole chapter on that.
So you had mentioned that, I think December 1944, when the Germans saw that the war was, that they were at that point trying to get rid of the evidence, basically. I had always heard that when they found out that they were losing, that they really ratcheted up. They were really concerned with killing as many Jews as possible. That seems like that's not necessarily the case.
No. There was, I think, a turning point. Mm-hmm. There was a turning point where the only thing they tried to do was to look good. And to look compassionate. I think there was such a turning point. Yeah. You what?
The Germans themselves, when the head SS were saying we're defeated in so many words, Eichmann ratcheted it up.
No, but that's still not when he's talking.
Yeah.
This is before he's talking. When they really started to empty the other camps, they weren't ratcheting it up anymore. There was a point when they were.
Okay. Even at the
No, not at the extreme end. I don't think so. Not at, it didn't make any sense. They couldn't do it anymore.
There's a map that Martin Gilbert has where you see Bergen-Belsen and you see the all these arrows come from all the camps going to the death marches going to Bergen-Belsen.
Yes?
Your parents have any contact with the family of Anne Frank?
We knew the Anne Frank family in Bergen-Belsen. My mother knew them. I was 2 years old. But my mother knew the family of Anne Frank. Somebody said that my book is the end of Anne Frank's book. That if Anne Frank had survived Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz, which she, of course she didn't, these are the kinds of things she would have written. She would not have written the stuff she wrote about how everybody's really beautiful and takes care of everybody. Yeah?
You were born in a camp?
No, I was born in Eindhoven in Holland. Not in Eindhoven, in a hospital near Eindhoven. Yes?
When did you go back to, you said you went back to your workplace?
Many times. In time in writing the book, yeah, several times.
Did it take a long time for you to get to be able to go back? I mean,
it's a good question. It's a good question. As many of you who know me for a long time, I used to do a lot of Holocaust programming at Boston University, always interested in the Holocaust, but never talked about my own personal experience in which I had no interest. Okay? So I was an expert in the Holocaust, but don't ask me what happened to me. And then in 1991 or 92, I was invited to give a paper to the Jewish Law Society in Paris. And I said, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to give this paper, I'm going to go. And I said, as I was packing, I said to my wife, Rachel, you know what? As long as I'm going to Paris, why don't I drop by and see what this place Bergen-Belsen is? And my wife almost fell off her chair. Because I had never done that before. And I described that visit to Bergen-Belsen in the book. And then I came back to BU and I made a series of public speeches, extremely well attended, 200 people coming to each lecture, and I was like a hero. I was finally facing my past. And then I decided that there's something really dishonest about this, because I didn't have the slightest idea why I was doing this. What kind of mishigas was motivating me to finally look at my past? So then I started to get serious about it. And I found a paper published, I still have it, published in the by the Bar-Ilan School of Social Work. They publish a therapy paper. And the paper says that child survivors of the Holocaust first start looking at their past when they turn 50. So, not only was I not a hero, but I happened to be right on schedule. And that's the story.
When we're little kids, how much do we remember from when we're little kids? It tends to be not a lot.
Well, that's a very good question. So, I sat with my kids, right? And I said with them, I said, tell me what you remember about this, this, and this. 2.5, 2, they remember. They remember. I checked it out. Also, there is nothing in my book, there's nothing in my book that's not independently checked out. Nothing to do with my memory.
Thank you very much, Roya Pollack. We will now have, for those who want to purchase the book and have Roya Pollack sign the book, we will do that now, and we'll give out benches for benching. Thank you all for coming. Thank you very much, Roya Pollack, for your very moving words. I think it's going to be staying on in our bones for a very long time, what you've said. Thank you all for coming, and we should come together for Simchas.